Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday, and today we look at a group of people who could have a major impact on the November election, young people. Of course, that impact is predicated on whether they turn out to vote. Young people, those under 30, are notorious no-shows on Election Day. Just over half participated in 2016, way less in the 2018 midterms. As a bloc, they make up about 25% of the electorate this year. And if Bernie Sanders' popularity is any indication, they have a major role to play. He's the guy they favor, and look where he is as we head into the South Carolina primary. At least he's the guy the Democratic young people favor. Experts say voter participation of those under 30 is not for lack of interest. So what is it? Dr. Sunshine Hillegas is a Duke University professor of political science and co-author of Making Young Voters, Converting Civic Attitudes into Civic Action. And she joins us from studios at Duke University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're nice to have you with us. And later in this program, we'll hear from two young voters, a Republican and the Democrat, to hear their thoughts on what motivates and what stands in the way of young voters going to the polls. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Bernie Sanders, Dr. Bernie Sanders' victory in Nevada, we think he won, on Saturday, came from three key groups. 49% were very liberal voters who supported him. Most Hispanic voters supported him, and 56% of voters under 44 supported him in the Iowa caucuses and at Bernie Sanders' rallies. It is young people who are rabid for him. Of course, young people aren't a monolith. But they are, as I said, one of the largest voting blocks in the electorate. So how would politics change in America if young people came out in force and voted?
So it is useful to remember that politicians listen to those who vote. And so there's a reason in this country that we spend a heck of a lot of money on Social Security and much less money on education. And so it is the case that young people as a larger share of the electorate would change who gets elected and what policies get implemented once in office.
So it would change substantially, is what you're saying, because young people would make their voices heard and politicians would respond.
At the same time, let's remember that demography is not destiny, and young people in particular do not have the same degree of loyalty and stability to one side or the other. So, you know, I think we want to be careful to talk about what the exact implications would be if young people were to be more involved in the election, so that while it might have an impact the first time they voted, voting at the end of the day is very habitual, and there is, in fact, you know, some changing that happens over the course of a lifetime in terms of preferences.
Well, in North Carolina, about one in five eligible 18 to 29-year-olds voted in recent presidential elections, with half of all adults doing so, which is pretty miserable when you think about people who are older than that not participating either. But when we talk just about young people, you say that the negative impact on our democracy of these young people not voting cannot be understated. That's a pretty big statement.
Not only that, but it is useful to recognize that the gap in turnout between young people and old people is larger in the United States than any other Western democracy.
Why?
So young people across the world are less likely to vote. And as we'll talk about, part of that has to do with, you know, where they are in life. And as they age, they become more likely to participate. But a lot of it has to do with the institutional and, you know, the electoral rules of the game that are much harder in the United States than in other countries. And so, you know, I think we take as a starting point that it doesn't have to be as bad as it is in the United States.
Hmm. older voters have a lot at stake. They have their 401ks, and they have Medicare, and they have Social Security programs that are important to them as they get older. Don't young people have something commensurate with that? I mean, all that's in the pipeline for them eventually if things don't go awry. Why don't they see that as a reason to go out and vote?
Well, and that's where I would say we are looking at it the wrong way. They do see it as a reason to vote, although I might say that student loans weigh a little bit more heavily on their minds these days. But they are motivated. They are interested. They do care about who wins the election, and 80% of them say they intend to vote. The problem comes in is they don't follow through on those intentions. And so, you know, what my co-author John Holbein and I have said is that we have been looking at this really from the wrong perspective. That, you know, rather than saying we need to get young people to be less apathetic and more interested, we need to figure out why it is they're not following through on their intentions to vote and why it is older people are.
Yeah, you say that 74% of these young people say they care about who gets elected. 76% say they are interested in politics. 81%, as you just said, say they intend to vote, and then they obviously don't. But boy, when they do, I'm just giving a note here that entrance polls in Nevada, and those were caucuses, so they're taking entrance, not exit polls, showed that Bernie Sanders got 68% of the under 30 vote. And Bernie Sanders is throwing a wrench into the works in the minds of a lot of conventional Democrats. He worries them, and it's because of young people's support. Do you think if young people look at this and they understand the power that they have, that might light a fire?
Again, I want to emphasize that it's not about those attitudes. They have those attitudes. The fire is lit. And what we want to focus on is why is it with that lit fire that we're not still seeing them turn out? And so I think if we focus on that part of the problem, that number one, we think there are a different set of solutions than simply, you know, emphasizing why it's important for them to vote, because they know it's important for them to vote. The question is what stands in the way.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because you said that adults who have 9-to-5 jobs, unlike college students and some younger people who are still putting jobs together and making 2 or 3 jobs work for them, people with 9-to-5 jobs know what their schedules look like, more predictable than if you're a college student who has a different schedule every day, you say. But is that really fair? Because most college, if they run college the way they did when I was there in the Pleistocene age, we had Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Tuesday, Thursday classes. You could pretty much predict what your school schedule looked like. So they know when election day is. Early voting gives them lots of time to go to a voting booth and pull the lever. Why can't they make that happen? Why is their schedule so much more difficult than mine?
So it's not just about schedule, although it is the case that just there is less consistency and stability and predictability in a young person's schedule that in part comes from what the constraints on their life are or are not relative to ours. But at the same time, it's also about where they are in the life cycle. And importantly, you know, it's not just they need to know that they have to vote on you know, the Tuesday in November, but it's also being registered 30 days in advance. And if they're a college student that came from out of state, they need to request an absentee ballot, or they need to figure out if they have the right voter identification in order to vote in the new state if they want to vote in the new state. So there are an enormous number of rules that govern when, how, and what we need in order to vote. And for a new voter, these are much more substantial barriers than for those of us who are experienced, have lived in the same house for a very long time, and have gone to the same precinct many other times. And to be fair, right, there is research that says if your precinct gets moved, it reduces turnout. So older people are also affected by the barriers that stand in the way. It's just that the barriers are both larger and more consequential for those who are younger and less equipped and less experienced to know exactly what they need to do to overcome them.
So when you talk about teaching students who will eventually be voting age about how the process works, is that what you're talking about, warning them that when they're in college they'll have to register? If they're out of state, they'll have to get a mail-in ballot. They have to register to do this or do that or change their residency in order to vote. Is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about something else?
So two different things. So what we show is that those individuals who are those young people who are more likely to follow through tend to have the non-cognitive skills that that are apparent in those who achieve their goals. So whether that is you have intentions to exercise and you follow through on that, or you plan to study for a test, you follow through on that. The fact that it takes grit and perseverance in order to vote suggests that there's two different things that we can be doing. One is reducing the barriers to participation. And that, again, involves the electoral rules. So states where there is pre-registration or online registration or automatic registration all see higher levels of youth turnout. Those rules have bigger impact on young and new voters than on older voters. Frankly, early voting allows for procrastination. it tends to be used by those who would show up on election day anyway. So early voting doesn't actually tend to expand the electorate. It just makes it more convenient for a subset of people who had already vote. So that's one thing, is we need to change the electoral rules. The other is about how we're teaching civics education, which is what we, right now, the focus is what we call bubble sheet civics. You know, you learn facts and figures about history and historic legal cases and government, and it's very disconnected from politics today. And it doesn't necessarily cover the exact process that people need to go through in order to vote. It turns out that in one study, almost half of college students messed up their voter registration form in some way, forgetting to sign it. They didn't have their Social Security number. There was something about the form that they made a mistake on. So there's also, you know, again, all of the rules that govern registration that vary across states. So there, you know, I think in the United States, we forget how complicated actually the various rules are. North Carolina, even crazier, right? Because we have had changes over the course of the last few years that make it far more difficult to know, you know, are you going to need a voter ID when you show up or not? If you can, which voter ID? You know, we had pre-registration, then it was taken away, and then it came back. And so, in fact, we had a youth advocacy group in 2016 tell us that they stayed out of North Carolina just because they couldn't figure out the rules of the game. Everything was in flux, so they invested the resources in another state.
We should point out you do not need a voter ID, a photo ID, to vote in the primary this March, and in all likelihood you will not need one in North Carolina for the general election, although that is subject to change
exactly.
Any day with a court order, I suppose. At what point do you think young people should be taught about this process, how you vote, what you have to do in order to be eligible to vote? Does that start in the fifth grade? Does it start in high school? When should that start in your mind?
Earlier the better, number one. And number two, I think that schools should be tasked with doing more in terms of the actual registration process. So we did a survey of North Carolina high schools to figure out what exactly they were doing. And it turns out it's a state law for high schools to make registration forms available, which is terrific. But what that means in different different high schools is very, very different. Sometimes it's a stack of forms at the counselor's office. Sometimes it's a table in the cafeteria. Others go through far more extensive preparation that ultimately is effective.
We're going to come back in a moment and talk more about what we can do to help young people become part of the process. Dr. Sunshine Hillegas is our guest. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Sunshine Hillegas is with us. She's a professor of political science at Duke University, where she is this morning, and she's the co-author of Making Young Voters, Converting Civic Attitudes into Civic Action. And we're talking at the moment about why young voters don't participate in the numbers that could actually give them a great say over the outcome of American elections. You have advocated younger and younger education for young people about the process, about how it works, about what's required. And evidently, you said that teachers of pre-voting age students have expressed a lot of hesitation about bringing politics into the classroom. And that prevents them from talking about this. But how is teaching people how to vote political?
And that's one of the points that we've wanted to make, is that, you know, there is kind of this running assumption out there that you increase youth turnout and it will inevitably lead to more liberal policies, more liberal candidates being elected. And I think at this moment in time, it very much feels like that would be the case.
Is that because young people are naturally more liberal and you become more conservative as you get older? Is that what the fear is?
Well, I mean, certainly that is something that is one direction that there tends to be a change. But the bigger thing is just that young people are far more likely to be unaffiliated, but also far more responsive to the context in which they come of age and they're making decisions. So what we find, for instance, is that when the economy is very poor, it's young people who are more likely to kind of jump ship from the incumbent. And so they tend to just be more likely to move. And now as they age and get more experience, they get more settled into their ways. But it would just be a mistake to assume that you, increase youth turnout and because that benefits, you know, Bernie Sanders this time around, that it will always lead to, one side being more likely to win.
You also say something about public schools that I think is really kind of interesting, and I don't know that a lot of people have thought about this. And you're talking about public schools in relation to teaching young people civics, essentially, but it's more than that. You and your co-authors say there's been too much emphasis in schools on passing standardized tests and getting kids ready for college, but not participation in civic life. And you're urging us to, quote, remember why public schools were made public in the first place, in large part to make an electorate that is informed and engaged. And I think you're absolutely right. All we care about is getting kids to pass these standardized tests, which tells the school system we're doing a great job, and then getting them ready for college, which gets them ready for a six-figure job, and not education for education's sake. Can you fix that in America today?
Absolutely. So this is one of the things that I would say that education policy scholars are starting to work on. There are specific efforts in various locations where they have attempted to experiment with different models. So service learning is something that increases youth turnout later. A focus on, again, the process, voting demonstrations, getting experience with the voting process, filling out registration forms in a classroom. These are all things that have impacts.
Are these the basic skills that you're talking about?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, and then also the other part of it is one of the debates within education policy right now is how much do we invest in what are called non-cognitive skills? These are the kind of soft skills that help people to achieve their goals, whatever those goals might be. So, you know, how much should we be teaching problem solving, perseverance, how to plan for and achieve those things that you want to achieve. And while that is more difficult to kind of evaluate on a multiple choice test, that in fact, that's one of the biggest predictors of success, across all domains. And what we are showing is that includes within the civic domain.
So those are the non-cognitive skills that you talk about in your book. And I was reading through that yesterday, I thought, how do you teach young people, how do you teach adults to think about how they might work together, teach them how to interact in a classroom, to work with their peers, and not to be, these are your words, hostile to others. as a way to prepare them for civic life when they see adult Republicans and adult Democrats active in the political arena who cannot have a civil conversation without childish name-calling and derogatory comments and just shutting down. How do you teach them that when they look at the real world and see, well, that's not how it works?
This is one of the reasons that it's so important that we figure this out. If teachers are avoiding talking about political issues because they fear the parents will respond in negative ways, then we are cutting off the next generation from learning the type of civil engagement and civil discussion, not to mention, right, the actual just engagement in the world around them that is relevant for participation. So this is so critical.
Can you teach these skills and divorce them from politics? Why do you have to be talking about issues like liberal or conservative issues or Republican or Democratic talking points? Why can't you use garbage collection as the topic and take both sides of it?
And garbage collection can be very political, but in fact, you can. So one of the things that we show is that experiments, one of them was called the Fast Track Experiment that happened in North Carolina, and researchers went into schools, elementary schools, disadvantaged students, and they taught them things like social skills and problem solving and perseverance. They had no interest in politics. This was simply just about trying to improve graduation rates, improve access to college, get kids to perform academically. What we did was we matched up voter records to these children who participated and found that it also had an impact on their turnout later in life. So it doesn't have to be about politics, right? That these non-cognitive skills are something that pay dividends both academically, economically, but also politically.
And you say teachers fear parents' reaction to their teaching these skills in the classroom and fear being fired for having done so. Is that based on anything more than just anxiety? Is it based on what they've seen happen to their peers?
So these are among the things that teachers talked about. And when we had qualitative interviews trying to figure out what are they doing and do they feel like they're doing as much as they would like to do. They did talk about standardized testing, saying the way, and then they also talked about this fear. Now, of course, there is a difference between registering to vote versus talking about policy issues, and I think it's very, very important that we separate those two things, and I am most concerned about just teaching the basic process of how to vote and, you know, what happens if you get to a polling place and there's a long line or your name is not, you know, on the rolls, figuring out how to problem solve in those cases. I want to go back to this point that, you know, things that seem so easy might be less so for new voters. And when we did interviews with young people, one woman told me that, you know, she really planned to vote. I mean, she was a political science major. She was very engaged in the campaign. But ultimately she just found that she didn't get around to it. Other things got in the way to registering. And she said, you know, how is it that I switch gears? Like, I'm used to being able to go online to Amazon and get what I ordered the next day, but I had to register 30 days in advance. And that kind of shift from, how daily life works usually versus what is necessary in terms of jumping through the hoops for voting has consequences.
Well, you said something a little while ago that kind of surprised me, that sometimes when they go to fill out these forms at the registrar's office to register to vote, they sometimes they fill it out incorrectly or they don't know their social security number. How can a college student not know that? Do the colleges not ask you for your social security number when you register for college? And God knows you have to jump through hoops to get into a college and fill out forms and all kinds of things. So if they can do that to get in, why can't they register to vote? Why is that such a greater challenge?
So keep in mind that most people are not going to the registrar to fill this out, that a lot of young people are encountering these forms in a variety of different ways. And maybe it's being collected by an activist and they don't want to put their social security number on it and don't realize that that means that their form is going to be rejected. So there's a variety of different things that are issues. It's one of the reasons that I think that we really want to get the high schools involved. The other thing I mentioned is the single biggest predictor of if a young person votes right now are their parents, right? Are their parents politically active? And part of what's going on is that the both the values but also the information about how to navigate voting is being passed on through parents to children, and that leaves out a whole heck of a lot of kids who don't have active parents, and that's where we need the school system to help equalize.
Of course, we've been talking a lot about young people who go to college and who are having trouble registering to vote. There are a lot of young people who don't go to college. Are their problems equal or different in some way?
Far larger. I mean, college campuses these days are actually they have been stepping up the game. So there are a number of national organizations that have started working with colleges to try and increase participation among college students. It is a much larger issue for those who don't go to college. They're far less likely to kind of encounter the opportunity to register and vote. Keep in mind that with the Help America Vote Act, that everyone can register to vote when they get their driver's license. But if you get your driver's license at 16, you know, there are a limited number of states where you could go ahead and register at that time. It's one of the things that we find in terms of electoral rules that is so effective is pre-registration, so that when you're as young as 16, you can go ahead and fill out the form, and that then means that hurdle is gone when it comes time to actually vote.
So we've been talking about young voters, so let's hear from some who are also political activists, a young Republican and a young Democrat, and to be fair, I'm going to introduce them alphabetically according to their last name so we don't favor one party over the other unnecessarily. J.D. Mazzarera is senior class president at Queen's University of Charlotte and former president of the Queen's College Democrats. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And John Waugh is a junior at UNC Charlotte and chairman of the College Republicans there. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So before we talk about voting, let's find out why the two of you identify with your particular parties. I want to hear from both of you. J.D., why are you a Democrat?
Well, a lot of policies have altered my life. I used to be a former undocumented citizen, mm-hmm. and I used to be a former DACA citizen. So I wouldn't have had it wasn't a clear pathway to citizenship, but any kind of pathway to citizenship if it wasn't for President Obama's deferred action for childhood arrivals executive order that kind of allowed me to get a license and go to work and to provide some type of living, not only for myself, but for my family.
So do you see yourself as being or having become a lifelong Democrat, or is this something that could change over time depending upon issues and the person involved?
Well, I think it can change as we see more young people become more issue-oriented than stick to their political party or a particular candidate. I mean, you guys spoke about that earlier about, you know, young people tend to not be loyal, you know, and
they change jobs all the time. So why not change parties all the time?
Yeah. So exactly. So I see that as a progressive issue. Yeah.
John, why are you a Republican?
Well, growing up in a small town in a middle class income household, I learned quickly that being a conservative is more than just lower taxes, smaller government, and those are values that I believe, but it's being more communicable to people.
What does that mean?
And what I mean by that is having a relationship with someone and understanding them, and I believe those are conservative values in my mind, and that's what I've learned growing up through being a Republican, through being in a family that is conservative, that is a Republican family. But I also have those values of smaller government and being limited and allowing the people to hold the power in policy and in the public.
So when you look at Democrats and when you hear Democratic arguments, particularly in this presidential campaign, What do you see? What do you hear as a Republican coming from that side?
In this campaign, this cycle, I would say more hostility than anything. And I wouldn't say that's so much because of each individual candidate. I would just say because of the amount of candidates and that each of them have to share their own beliefs or a similar belief in a different way.
But in terms of policy, what do you hear?
I hear health care for all.
And how does that hit you?
It hits me as people lose their employer-based health care, and as a family who...
Did you come to that conclusion, or is that just a Republican talking point?
That's what I hear. That's what I've heard.
Okay.
And based on what I've seen is that employer-based health care diminishes.
Same question to you, J.D. When you look at the president, of course, it's been quieter on the Republican side in some ways because there are no debates because the president is the presumptive nominee, but he does tweet on a daily basis. So what do you see when you look at Republican arguments, Republican issues, Republican points of view, and the president? What do you see?
I see a lot of scapegoating to communities that are marginalized, particularly minority communities, immigrant communities. People that have built this country on their backs. That's what I see when I look at the Republicans. I see a lot of divisive language, a lot of hateful rhetoric towards people that, quite frankly, aren't the majority, so Caucasian people.
If you took away the hateful, what you called hateful rhetoric, do they have a point about some of these issues?
I would say Medicare for All is a strong point. You know, No.
I mean, when you take away the hate-filled speech that you perceived coming from Republicans, do Republicans have a point on some of these issues?
I don't think so. I don't see clearly as to why it's other people's fault for problems that were created with everyone involved in the country.
So, is there middle ground, guys?
I'm sure there is. I mean, through compromise and talking.
Would you go out and have a cup of coffee with each other?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And
sure. Why not?
And you could talk to each other about these things?
Yeah.
Well, that's hopeful. I understand this is going to be the first presidential election in which you can vote, J.D. Is that correct? Is that true for you too, John?
It is my second presidential election.
Okay. What does that mean for you to be able to vote, J.D.?
I mean, it's a powerful feeling, I would say, because... being eligible to vote in the past but not being a citizen was kind of frustrating to see the results. And now I feel like I do have a say in it despite all this conversation about the Electoral College.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to find out how it feels to the two of you who are obviously politically active at a young age when you find out that a lot of your peers don't. They don't vote. And they care, but they don't vote. We're going to get your point of view on that and more. We're coming back with J.D. Massarera, John Waugh, and Dr. Sunshine Hillegas in a moment at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about young people in politics, young voters, and why they are underrepresented when it comes to voting every single election. On this Politics Monday, Dr. Sunshine Hillegas is an expert on this topic. She's a professor of political science at Duke University, where she is this morning, and the co-author of Making Young Voters, Converting Civic Attitudes into Civic Action. And we also have in our studio two young politically oriented people. John Waugh is a Republican. He's a junior at UNC Charlotte and the chairman of the College Republicans there. And J.D. Massarera is former president of the Queen's University College Democrats and currently a senior class president there. So we've heard Dr. Hillegas talk about the difficulties, the obstacles that young people face, particularly young people in college who may not be in their home states or their home cities when they're at the university. And her co-author, John Holbein, from the University of Virginia, says the act of voting is costly. He says citizens have to expend time and effort familiarizing themselves with candidates and policies, decide which they prefer, and then overcome life's distractions long enough to find the right polling station on the right day. Okay. You guys are in college. You go through the same process, it seems to me, when choosing a movie to go to. You got to find out what movie you want to see, what time it plays, where it is, how long it takes to get there on time. Why is voting more difficult, John?
I would say it's a lack of information is a big piece of it. You know, we register voters on campus all the time, and multiple times, I can't really tell you how many, we have people come up and asking, you know, I don't live here. I live 4 hours away. There's no way I'm going home. Like, how can I vote? And I say, you know, an absentee ballot or a mail-in ballot. And they don't know where to go to get that information. They don't know how to find it. And, of course, we help to, right, we help to direct them and give them that clarity to go and get the absentee ballot. And then it's the point of getting the absentee ballot, filling it out, and making sure you mail it in properly. And I think there's a lack of information on that. And then also, you don't always know your polling place. You get it when you get your card when you first register. You get it when you get your card. You know where it is. But other than that, you would have to do an NC voter lookup. Well, how many people know our age? You can look
you
up our voter registration. You guys
are experts on the internet.
You're right. But how many people truly know that, oh, you can look up what I'm... I mean, they probably don't know with public
Google
knowledge.
It.
You're right. But do they?
What about you, JD? What's your point of view on that?
I think there's just so many obstacles in terms of, like, filling out the paperwork, you know, Social Security. And quite frankly, what I've seen a lot as an organizer is embarrassment of not knowing some information on this form, such as Social Security. Or if you are at a college campus, which my college campus is mostly liberal, like some conservatives don't register to vote because they feel like they're going to be judged by whoever is doing the voter registration drive by putting their political party. And so over the summer, I was an organizer here in Charlotte, and I went to marginalized communities, and they were embarrassed because either some didn't know how to write, didn't know what their Social Security number was. Some homeless people didn't have an address. And it was quite frankly embarrassing. And to go to also that point, one of the biggest mistakes that people do while registering to vote is forgetting to sign the form.
Wow.
That is something that we saw time and time again throughout Charlotte is signing the form. And if nobody signs it, then you can't register properly.
So there is embarrassment, but there's also distrust. Shalona emails, many of the young people I have spoken to have very little faith in our political system. A great number of them don't believe that their votes count. Some felt this way prior to 2016 and question if anything has changed. Bob emails, perhaps 40 years of conservative and neoliberal rule has created a distrust of government. This distrust disaffects many from participating. Maybe this is why Bernie has traction with young voters. Doctor, what about this distrust element? What about being embarrassed because you don't want somebody to know that you're either a Republican or a Democrat? Nobody's business, but you got to put it on that form.
I think this is one of the things that I want to come back to is what is it that we are teaching in the schools in terms of, you know, what people need to know and what they should know. So one of the other sources of embarrassment that I often encountered was that even if people got through the registration process, which again, for a lot of people is not hard, but you know, there are a number, young people are especially likely to have more complicated situations that they have to figure out. But that then they think that in order to be a qualified voter, they need to do extensive research on every single race, on every single issue, and that's what it means to be informed and qualified. Whereas older people, what we find both in surveys and qualitative interviews is, by God, they vote no matter what, right? They realize that we can do a pretty good job of muddling through figuring out if a D or an R is better for our interests and have no qualms with voting straight. Ticket. Younger people are far more likely to be opposed to, you know, just even theoretically to the notion of straight ticket voting because they think, and I think this is partly a reflection both of partisan politics, which they don't necessarily want to be associated with, but also the way we teach civics, that, you know, it's very knowledge and fact-based, and so they think that they need to have extensive levels of information. We also think about the information environment. And you can never be informed enough, right? You could always continue to do research on the issues and the candidates. And so that is a personal barrier that young people think in terms of their own expectations.
If these young people think they have to know everything about every candidate and every issue, I think that's a positive, because you want informed voters to go to the polls to make a good decision. On the other hand, if older people are just voting because they've always voted Republican or they've always voted Democrat and they're going to pull the lever for whatever they think is going to suit them, they think, but they don't know because they haven't done the research, I'm not sure I want them voting. On the other hand, young people who want to vote, who care about the issues but just can't motivate, who can't figure out the process, do we want them voting?
Now, I want to push back on that some, because okay. the reality is that my guess is if I quizzed you about, you know, the city council race and the issues and the candidates, maybe you would know. But, I mean, I'm a political science professor, and I can't tell you every single candidate running in every single race and all the issue positions, right? That, you know, there is an incredibly high bar. The reality is, though, is that I am absolutely competent in making a decision about how to vote. And so are everyone else. It doesn't take as much as young people think it takes in order to be a competent and rational voter. That
so John,
we do a pretty good job of figuring it out.
John, you rolled your eyes when I said that. So
well,
go ahead. Jump in.
I think being an educated voter is very important when it comes to national elections and local elections, really, because in local elections you deal a lot more with retail politics, especially I'm from Statesville, North Carolina, so it's a little smaller, mm-hmm. and we have city council races that you will only win by 3 or 8 votes. And so being a more informed voter in those kind of races, I think, is more important. But also in national elections, you're voting on a president, you're voting on the leader of this country, and to be educated is important. However, I don't think, especially like I said before the show, you know, the Democrats are having 12 debates. I don't think we're going to learn anything new in the next, I think there's 5 left, next 5 debates that we don't already know about them. So
except for the potential fireworks.
Right. Yeah. And I agree with the professor that you can learn a lot about someone within this, right. the first 6 or 5 or whatever we've had already and be a competent voter going to the polls.
UNC Charlotte is a bigger school than Queen's University of Charlotte is, but how many young Republicans are in your organization?
We have about 50 to 60 on our roster, I believe.
Okay. How about the Democrats over, the young Democrats over at Queens?
We have around 30 and 30 to 40 on our roster, but usually 20 attend the meetings.
You have said, John, that you don't think candidates, and I'm assuming that you're referring to presidential candidates, that young people don't feel as if candidates always speak to them.
I think that's a big, when you talk about the youth voter voting, I think that's part of it, is that, you know, candidates see that, oh, young people aren't, you know, necessarily the big crowd that's going to vote, so we'll appeal to those who are voting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you get that generational kind of push to where our generations and the millennials are voting, then candidates will obviously start to appeal to younger voters.
Over on the Democratic side, the majority of young people are listening to Bernie Sanders and not to the youngest candidate in the race, Pete Buttigieg, or anybody in between. What is that attraction? What is Bernie, aside from free college and forgiveness of student debt, what is Bernie saying to these that makes them interested in him and not the other candidate?
Well, I think he's saying that, you know, I'm listening to you. I think your opinion matters. I think something that Bernie does extremely well is not only focus on college-educated young people, which is usually where all the voter registration drives happen in college campuses, but what about the other young people, like you said earlier, the people that don't go to college, the people that live in lower-income communities, West Charlotte, East Charlotte? What about those people? Are there people on the ground right now doing voter registration drives at the local Compare Foods, at the local food line, at the gas station? There's not. I mean, I did this summer, and I got a lot of people excited to vote. And I think that's what Bernie Sanders does right with young people. I mean, he is 12 points up in favorability among young black people against Joe Biden. Whereas, I mean, Joe Biden is seen to be the candidate that has the most black American support.
You've suggested, Doctor, that registering new voters on the day after an election would be effective. Why?
Well, and this goes back to the point that too many high schools are simply putting out that table in the cafeteria during a presidential election year and, you know, hoping that that's an effective way to register young people when, in fact, you know, what we want to be able to do is have registration to be constant, that it is happening in the classroom, that it is targeted not only to those who are eligible to vote, but also to those within North Carolina and other states that have it to pre-register. And even in those states where you don't have pre-registration, because eligibility is determined based on your age at the next election, it does mean the day after the election, right? There's a whole bunch of people who are then eligible to complete the registration form and might be feeling regret over the election outcome. And again, you know, when we can capitalize on increased salience and increased interest, we should be.
So when you hear a Republican or the president talk, mm-hmm. does it scare you?
It does.
When you hear the Democratic candidates talk, John, do they scare you?
Sure, yeah.
Is that the motivation that young people should have to go out and vote to eliminate fear, or should they be motivated by other things?
I think it should be not fear directly, but I think it's what candidates are saying should motivate them, depending on which way you view or not. But I also think that another way to motivate them is also seeing what's being done. You know, look at the candidate's record. Is there a record beforehand? Is there a record now? And is it positive or negative? And I think that's part of being an educated voter.
And you've said, J.D., that young people today are more interested in issues than they are in candidates, and where they support a particular candidate is because of that person's stand on the issues. I figured that was always the case, but that's the way I've done it. But and that's how they choose their candidate, issues, not on electability. And there's a great deal of concern in the Democratic Party, being fed by the Republicans, no question, that Bernie Sanders is not an electable candidate. But if you love what he says about the issues that are important to you on the one hand, and you're convinced that he's not electable, do you still vote for him?
Oh, that's a good question. I say there's various factors to take into consideration, and I think you should be able to balance those out. I think you should be able to like what a candidate says, but also think about their electability. But again, nothing is set in stone. We don't know come November who is going to win. We can't decide that. And we can't be, I can't be personally, an amateur political pundit and say, well, yeah, these are the polls. I mean, the polls lied to us in 2016. They can lie to us again. Will mislead us.
How did they lie to you?
Well, all the polls came out saying Hillary Clinton was going to win.
Actually, that is a common perception, but it's also a misperception because the pollsters will tell you, no, we told you what was going to happen. You just didn't read it right.
So I still think the most important thing is for those who support Bernie to nonetheless vote if he's not the nominee, for those who support any of the candidates, right, that the decision that it's one candidate or bust is one of the things that you know, I think that is a core message that I would get out there is that we want to get people into the system now and not to have, you know, the one candidate or bust attitude.
In your book, and I only have about a minute left, in your book you put forth one possible reason that young people don't vote. You say rather than voting, they are channeling their political interest into other forms of civic engagement, protests, online activism, or volunteering. Are they kidding themselves? Can you really move the needle if you don't vote?
And that's why we say at the end of the day, even if you are engaged in civic life in other ways, that if we want to impact policy, if you want to impact who is in power, you have to vote.
For the two of you as young people, just beginning your adult lives and beginning your participation in the process, are you hopeful that we can avoid the kind of rancor and inability to do anything in Congress, in the White House, et cetera? Can we come back to a time when Democrats and Republicans can work together? And I have 10 seconds for you, John.
I think they can, and I think there is that possibility in the next 4 years.
And I'll give you 10 seconds, JD.
I think so, too. I think we're tired of what we're seeing in national politics, and I think we want to go back to where we can talk to each other.
That's JD Mazzarera. He's the senior class president of Queen's University of Charlotte and a former president of the Queen's University College Democrats. John Waugh is a junior at UNC Charlotte, chairman of the College Republicans there. And Dr. Sunshine Hillegas, professor of political science at Duke University, co-author of Making Young Voters, Converting Civic Attitudes into Civic Action. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.